Sylvia and me.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, this is Candace Leitner, and this is Sylvia and me.
Candace Leitner is the founder of MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and has now gone on to establish We Save Lives. Candace is recognized as the moving force behind reshaping the nation's attitude toward drunk driving. Candace is an activist, a motivational speaker, victim advocate, an author, a producer, and an international speaker. You've been called the mother of movements. People magazine called you the conscience of a nation. I am so delighted to have you, Candace, on our podcast today. In 1980, your teenage daughter was murdered by a habitual drunk driver. The loss of a child is unimaginable. But you had a chance encounter with the police one night shortly after Carrie's murder that led you on a journey that changed your life and in turn has saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of others. As I've heard you say, you've turned tragedy into triumph. Could you, if I may ask, kind of go over what that chance encounter with the officers that night was and how that precipitated you starting Mothers Against Drunk Driving?
Yeah, I think it was the day after a funeral. Anyway, the police had just called me, the California Highway Patrol, to tell me they found the man who killed her and that he was arrested. And I asked how his family was, and they told me that they were, you know, dealing with it. And I asked if he had any children, and they said yes, two teenagers about the same age as Carrie. And that's really all they told me. So we decided to go out to dinner, and as we were leaving, where she was hit was not far from the house, and they, California Highway Patrol, were yellow taping it because it was now a crime scene. And I went up to them and I said, you know, are you investigating the death of Carrie Leitner? And they said yes. And I said, well, I'm her mother, Candy, which I was known as then, Candy. And they said, oh, and I said, I understand that, you know, the man has been arrested. And they said, oh, they called and told you. And I said, yes. And they said, well, did they tell you that he was out on bail from another hit-and-run drunk driving crash? And I said, yes, which they hadn't told me. They hadn't told me anything except that he was arrested and about his family. And they said, well, did they tell you he was had four prior drunk driving convictions? And I was like, yes, even though I didn't know any of this.
Unbelievable.
But I was afraid if I said no, they wouldn't finish telling me all this stuff. And they said, well, did they tell you he was driving on a valid California driver's license? And I said, still driving on a California driver's license. And I said, yes, and even though I didn't know that. And they said, did they tell you he was drunk at the time he killed your daughter? And I said, yes, and I didn't know that either. So I made the assumption that any normal parent would make. I said, well, how long will he go to prison? And they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, how long will he go to prison for killing my daughter? And the cop kind of chuckled, and he looked at me, and he said, lady, you'll be lucky to see any jail time, much less prison, because that's the way the system works. And so, yes, I was mulling this over in my head, and I was telling everybody about it. And the more I thought about it, the angrier I got that somebody could kill my child and get away with it. And so my sister said, I know you, Andy, I know you well. You're not going to let this go. And I said, you're right, I'm not. I'm going to start an organization. And my girlfriend piped up and said, you're going to call it MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, which it was initially. And that's what set it off. And I said, yeah, I am. Not having a clue what I was doing. Not a clue. But, you know, passion can motivate a lot of people.
Oh, yes.
Passion and anger.
And one of the things that sometimes gets lost is you were a single mom. You had two other children, one of whom I believe Carrie's identical twin.
Carrie was a twin, her sister Serena, and then I had my son Travis, whom, as you probably know, had been run over when he was four by a drug driver and was in a coma and suffered permanent brain injuries. So he took some care. And I mean, we were very fortunate because he survived and he did well considering, but we did have some ongoing issues with him. So yes, I was a single parent, very single.
And you started this on your own.
I did. And then within about 3 months or so, one of the gals, I worked in real estate, and I was at the office one day, and I was called to go do something for Matt. And she said to me, her name was Sue, and she said, "Do you need help with this?" And I went, "Yes." "Yes, please." And she became like my right and left hand. I mean, God, I don't know what I would have done without her. She was invaluable. And she really was. And so, I started with her, and then, you know, eventually some other people would volunteer here and there. But it really didn't turn into a movement until after we had generated some major press, and which took about maybe 4 months. But still, all things considered, it was unbelievable. It was like, you know, all of a sudden, everybody saw this movement that they could relate to. All these victims came forward. It was unbelievable, the people that called me and the stories that I would hear from all over the country of people whose children, in most cases children, every once in a while it might be a wife or a spouse or whatever, but most of the time it was children, have been killed in drunk driving crashes and crimes, and nothing had happened. Absolutely nothing had happened. And they saw this as a way of, I guess, building a legacy to their child and doing something positive in the face of so much devastation. And thank God they did, because it became an incredibly powerful grassroots organization.
Yes, it did. And, you know, one of the things is your perseverance and the fact that you wouldn't take no for an answer. You really pushed to get to meet Governor Brown at that time. You were living in California. And from what I understand, you really pushed and wouldn't let down in getting to see him.
Yeah, we had started a petition drive for Governor Brown in California to initiate a governor's task force to solve. We always emphasize solve the problem of drunk driving. And we had started this petition drive when I kicked off Matt in August at the first press conference. And so I wanted to meet with him, to talk to him about drunk driving and what we could do as a state. And he was not interested. So after calling a number of times and getting nowhere, I would go sit in his office. I would sit there. I was so obnoxious. But I would sit there, and sometimes I'd take in donuts, and I took in a bunch of balloons and sat there with a bunch of balloons. So we were getting ready to go back to Washington, D.C. and do a major press conference there, calling on the president to form a presidential commission to solve the problem of drunk driving. And I thought I would be very strategic, and I called the governor's aide, one of the people in the governor's office that I had been communicating with, and I said, "Look, I'm going back to Washington, D.C. I'm going to be at a major press conference with congressmen, senators, and you know the press is going to ask me," because they were starting to take note then, whether or not I've gotten in to see Governor Brown, and it would be nice if I could say I have a meeting with him when I get back. And he said, "Mrs. Leitner, if you say anything about the governor at all," he said, "I'll make sure you never get in to see him." And so I went into some kind of a quandary, like, well, do I say something? Do I not say anything? Do I jeopardize my chances? What do I do? So the first question after we did our thing, we actually picketed the White House, and then I was with Cindy Lamb, whose daughter Laura was the youngest quadriplegic in the world as a result of a drunk driver, and we were getting ready to answer questions, and one of the reporters piped up. He was from the LA Times, and he said, Mrs. Leitner, I understand you've been trying to see the governor. And I said, yes. And he said, have you had any success? And I said, no. And I remembered that he had been traveling up and down the state because California was having a problem with tsetse flies or whatever they were that were killing the crops. And he'd been visiting farmers and stuff. And he said, well, I said, no, he seems to be more concerned with tsetse flies than he does with dying children. So I figured, well, I can just kiss that meeting goodbye. That was the headlines in the newspaper.
Oh, nice.
So ironically, when I got back, to make a long story short, I had a meeting in the governor's office, so I was able to go back and see him. And he said, I've heard a lot about you. And I said, I'm sure you have. And he said, tell me what you want. I said, I want a governor's task force to solve the problem of drunk driving. And he said, you've got it. And I didn't believe him. And I didn't listen. I didn't hear him. So I started quoting statistics. And he said, no, you've got it. You've got it. And that's one of the few times I cried, actually. And I did. I started crying. And I said, well, I take back all those awful things I said about you.
Okay.
And he laughed. So that's how it started. And, of course, I was on the task force. And I worked very closely with him. I mean, I have to say, he really, really came through. And we actually initiated several bills in California, which at that time were the toughest in the nation. It was very empowering for me to see that someone like me, who when I started that wasn't even a registered voter, although I did go out and register, could have that kind of an impact on politicians and then on the public.
Well, change is possible. I know you've said that also recently. In fact, you had something where your first day of lobbying in Sacramento, you had somebody tell you something to the effect of, if you don't like the way this country operates, leave it.
Yeah, I did. He was a male politician. He was a legislator, and I'd gone in to see several that day, and it was my first day. So, and it had not been a good day or a successful day. I was explaining to him why we needed better laws and tougher sanctions, and he kept saying, no, what we have is fine. And I said, no, we really need to do this. And he finally got so frustrated that he threw his arms up in the air and pointed to the door. And he said, if you don't like the way this country operates, leave it. Literally threw me out of his office. I did.
Well, that's certainly...
I left. Not the country, but I left his office. You know, and I thought... And I'm so glad I obviously didn't leave it, and decided this country was worth changing. Which I did. So anyway, yeah, I did. I did. And when I heard that, it just resonated with me because I had been told the same thing. Anyway.
And, you know, your perseverance, your passion, your courage to move forward, it takes a lot. And I give you so much credit. From MAD, you now have started, I think it was a few years ago, We Save Lives.
Yeah, after I left MAD, I did a number of other things, including co-writing a book called Giving Sorrow Words, How to Cope with Grief and Get On with Your Life, because I actually didn't grieve as much with MAD. MAD dealt with my anger very
yes.
well. It didn't deal with the rest of my grief. And so, and I kept hearing people saying, I don't understand why you're still grieving. You know, it's been 5 years.
Hi.
And so I wanted to dispel the myths of the phases, of the five phases of grieving. These are really the five phases of dying. And so I became really interested in the topic, and I had already been a trained facilitator, grief facilitator. We put the book together, which is just, to me, a fabulous book on grieving and mourning. And then I guess it was about 4 or 5 years ago, I'm not sure exactly when, but I was actually asked by people in the safety movement who were concerned about highway safety because they felt that some of the organizations were ineffective, including MAD. And they asked me if I'd consider coming back and starting another movement. And at that time, I was really concerned about distracted driving, and we didn't have a national organization dealing with distracted driving. And I was becoming really concerned with drugged driving because of some of the consulting work I had done. So I decided I wanted to broaden the concept to drunk drugs and distracted driving, and that's how I started We Save Lives.
And one of the campaigns that you have under We Save Lives is the hashtag but not while driving, which I know that you have on your signature on your emails, specifically when it says, you know, it's coming from your phone, and the hashtag is but not while driving. And the other campaign that you have under We Save Lives is Courage to Intervene campaign, which I had actually never heard of before. And in reading it, it's a fabulous campaign, and it does take courage to intervene. Can you expand a little on what that campaign is all about?
Yeah, we actually have a number of campaigns. Those are just two of them. And we have one called Crash Versus Accident. And we're actually getting ready to release a video on that one. And that one I'm really going to be excited about. Courage to Intervene came about, and I still think this, I mean, to this day, the man who killed my daughter when he was released on bail went right to the neighborhood bar and drank himself silly, to the point where he blacked out after he killed my child. And all I keep thinking of, not all, but the dominant theme with me is, why didn't the bartender cut him off? Why didn't somebody stop? Why didn't somebody call his wife? Why didn't someone intervene? And if they had, my daughter would still be alive today. And I started hearing stories from people about, you know, their loved ones being killed, and they may have been at a party or they were at a wedding or whatever. And people knew they were intoxicated, and yet nobody had the courage to say anything or do anything. And it really started to bother me. And when you say to someone, don't drink or drive, they're like, yeah, right. But and that message is not resonating, by the way, and we know it's not resonating. And I thought, well, rather than say don't, which doesn't seem to work, why don't we ask them instead to do something proactive and positive? And that's to intervene when somebody's going to drive drunk, drugged, or distracted. And it's been amazing, the stories that I've heard, including some people that have actually intervened since this came out. I had a friend of mine, and she was on a bus going up to, I think, New York, and the bus driver was texting while he was driving the bus, and she went up and said, you stop that or I'm going to report you. And he did. And, I mean, can you imagine? And so, I mean, I feel so strongly that we could almost do away with laws if more people were interested, or not interested, but cared enough about life. It's such an easy, simple thing to do. And people, for some reason, really don't have the courage
That's it. That's the word. They don't have the courage. They don't want to lose a friendship. They don't want to be the bad one. I mean, it's, you know, you can go on and on as to the ridiculous reasons that run through people's heads as to why they wouldn't do something. And as you said, intervening to stop someone from doing something that you know is going to be harmful to them, to others, and is just not safe on so many levels. Well, every step of the way, you have not only persevered, you've pushed through, you haven't taken no for an answer. Somehow you've been responsible for the passage of more than 500 bills, both on a local, state, and national level. You also were responsible behind the movement and the law, you know, raising the drinking age. Can I ask why, what precipitated you pushing to raise the drinking age to 21?
Because the drinking age was different in different states. So one state it might be 18, another 19, another 20, another 21. What would happen is the kids would cross over the borders, and we had developed something in this country known as blood borders, and they were crashing and killing each other. And at that time, drunk driving was the number one cause of death of young people between the ages of 16 and 25. So we looked at the research, and we chose the drinking age of 21 because most of the states at that time, I believe, had 21.
They did.
And Yeah, and we decided that that's the age we wanted. And so, hence, we worked to raise the drinking age to 21, and it worked. We saved lives. We eliminated blood borders. I mean, thousands of teenagers or young people are alive today that wouldn't have been alive. They're now adults that wouldn't have been alive if we hadn't raised the drinking age to 21.
So you moved beyond your grief, and I know, like you said, you were with MAD for a number of years, and then afterwards, you know, MAD, you were working through anger, and people didn't understand that you hadn't really grieved yet. How were you able to handle people who would say to you, it's been 5 years, why are you, you know, all of a sudden now, or why are you still grieving? You know, you've been so busy doing other things. I thought you had already done it. How did you handle that?
Well, number one, I used to get upset. And as you know, you learn when you read my book, grieving is a lifetime process. You know,
it is.
You don't really move beyond grief. It's a lifetime process. It's the beginning. I break it down into three stages: the beginning, the middle, and the rest of your life. Thank you. And I would tell people, look, there's no timeline on grief, and there isn't, and that's an unrealistic expectation. And I've had so many people say to me about someone else, well, you know, she's still grieving and it's been a year. I'm like, yeah.
Really?
And people put unrealistic expectations on you, I think, too. And we put them on ourselves. It's like, oh my God, you know, it's been 6 months and I'm still in denial, you know, so I, you know, I would just explain to them, it's a lifetime process. There is no time limit for grief. And this is my pain. And, you know, and I would hear that more from people who had never lost anyone. So they had absolutely no understanding whatsoever of grief and mourning.
Yes, that's usually what happens in so many things in life. Mm-hmm. Grief, especially. Events happen that people don't realize, who haven't experienced them, they just assume that people, you know, they see pictures, they watch movies, and they make up their own assumptions. And then other people go by what they felt and what their experience was, and they don't understand that everyone is different. As I told you before, in my family, we had a loss, and my parents handled it differently. You know, each
you mean
one.
Your father handled it differently from your mother? And
yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And that's not unusual.
No.
At all.
But you can't step back and say, hey, you know, that person should be this way, that person should be that way. Everyone needs to be able to handle it in their own way.
It's really hard for people. I know you remember, but a lot of people, depending upon their age, like if I get up to go speak, I have to say, I'm going to take you back 40 years ago. And I have to tell them what it was like, because they don't understand that. They think it was always like it is now, and it wasn't. And when I tell my story and I tell how many times he'd been arrested and, you know, that we couldn't find anybody at that time who'd actually gone to prison for felony drunk driving anywhere in the country, you know, they're stunned. They're startled. You can hear the gasp. It's like they can't believe it. And then you bring them forward. So that's what we're going to do is show, I mean, I say this probably with no humility whatsoever, I am credited with changing the culture of a nation. And that's exactly what happened. It was a cultural change and a major cultural change.
Major. I mean, I remember when the drinking age got raised, and when the laws were put in. But as you said, young people today do believe that MAD was always, you know, was always around, that this is the way it always was. They have no idea how it started. And I don't think they could even fathom the fact that it was not a crime before.
No, and I'll tell you, it's really funny because on Facebook, there are a number of victim pages, you know, for drunk driving, et cetera. And I'll see the posts, and there are people that are really unhappy because somebody got 9 years for killing their child or whatever. And I'm like, whoa, 9 years. I would have given my ID to have gotten 9 years 40 years ago. And sometimes it's hard for me to, you know, when they're so angry and unhappy about it, it's hard for me to relate to that because 9 years when Carrie was killed was just unheard of, and it wasn't going to happen. And maybe it's still not enough, but it's so much better than it used to be.
Exactly. And, you know, change is possible. Change does happen. Change does not happen overnight. And as you said, you know, somebody getting 9 years as opposed to what the man who murdered Carrie got, which was next to nothing, that's a huge movement.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it really is. He didn't go to prison. He actually went to a halfway house. And he still drove. He still had his driver's license. Until I raised so much hell that they've DMV finally said, gee, maybe we better do something about this. But then the day he got released, he got his driver's license back, and then he hit another girl drunk driving, who happened to have the same name as my daughter and same age as she would have been had she lived. I mean, some people should not ever drive, you know. And I used to say this: if you have an alcohol problem, it's your problem. You get behind the wheel of a car, it becomes my problem. And I knew alcoholics who didn't drive because they were alcoholics, and they're, I, you know, to me, you're talking about criminal people who they may have an addiction, but they're still criminals because you don't have to drive.
So what is necessary to be a successful advocate?
A passion, a strong belief that you're right, that you have right on your side, but an ability to listen to the other side and compromise, which is something I don't see anymore, especially in politics. And I was in a movement some years ago. It was a dialogue group between Arabs and Jews, and it was absolutely fascinating. And I'm actually getting ready, I think, to do a blog about it. I love dialogue groups, and we don't have enough of them. We don't discuss anymore. We accuse and yell and give our position, but that's it. And I think you have to have a real ability to listen to the other side and to learn to compromise. I think you need to be willing to hear what the other side is and sees you can't come to a reasonable agreement. You need to be willing to give up your life, your income, seriously. You know, and focus on what you're doing. You have to be very focused to do something like this. It has to become your life and a priority, and which my children often say to me that it was. But it's like being an entrepreneur of any business, you know, like
Steve right.
Jobs at Apple or whatever. I mean, you're starting a business, even though it's a crusade. It's still a business. So, and I think it takes a lot of courage and willingness to take hits, and I took a lot of hits. And if you're sensitive, it isn't. Don't do this. Seriously, don't do this because it's not going to work. You have to be willing to sort of go with the flow, and go with the flow in the sense of listening to the criticism and not taking it personally.
That's key.
But also not taking no for an answer. So I didn't want to make it sound like going with the flow meant you agreed with everything.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Right.
Yeah. You listen, you go with the flow, and then you put in your two cents.
Right.
Right. Are you kidding?
Right. But you also need to back up what you're doing with facts and figures, which
definitely.
Yeah.
Data, knowledge is power. You know, people collect data, but they have no idea what to use it for. Well, there's usage for, you know, again, knowledge is power, and you do have to back up what you, you know, what you believe in if you're going forward.
Right, right.
Candace, I thank you so much. You are a role model, not just for people in general, but for women. You didn't take, you know, it didn't put you down. You moved forward. You did something that most people would not be able to do. And you did change the culture of the nation. So I thank you. I look forward to reading your blogs. And again, thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
To find out more about Candace, visit her on her website at www.candaceleitner.com. Thank you for joining me today. On our next podcast, I'll be talking with another extraordinary woman. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartRadio, and of course, our website, lifeofprey.com. Listen, subscribe for free, and take us with you wherever you are. This has been a Life of Prey production.